city and you can go. Then we'll get to 7 if we get that far. But I'm all excited about 7, don't we?
We've got to get to 7.
And there's nothing else all day. There's 7 sections. Now, a little short section, 6-7 verses. Let me see about that. Well, in the 10th verse, we learned that Oliver Cowdery has a blessing. Remember, it's addressed to Oliver Cowdery. And it's in 10. Blessed art thou hast a gift, and blessed art thou because of thy gift. Remember, it is sacred and cometh from above. Should I talk about the 7th now? I will.
Because I put a piece of chalk on the floor, and now I can really go to town. There's the chalk.
Now this 7th section comes as a surprise. This is a new type of thing. This introduces us into a historical situation which is very, very interesting. Introduces us into a world whose existence wasn't suspected until our own time. This belongs to the 40-day literature, the preaching of the Lord to the apostles after the resurrection. It's a great literature. It also points to the Dead Sea Scrolls. It has some very interesting affinities here. And it introduces us, almost casually, to another ancient mystery, as if Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery used the Urim and Thummim almost routinely, as far as I know, because they learned this by the Urim and Thummim. This is just full of information, the seventh chapter here. First then, on April 29th, when Oliver Cowdery and Joseph inquired through the Urim and Thummim as to whether John the Beloved tarried in the flesh or died. This is the alternative. The alternative is neither. I mean, the solution is neither. That's a very interesting thing. How did they do it? How did you operate a Urim and Thummim? First, we're not going to that because we've had plenty of descriptions of the Lord using Urim and Thummim in translating the Book of Mormon, and so I'm not going into that now. But it all sounds absurd to us up to this point. Were it not far from absurd results? What are the results of this? This is the test we have to do. It's called the translated version. This section is called the translated version of a record made on parchment by John and hidden up by himself. Well, here is a strange document. Have any of these? Here we learn that John himself made a record on parchment and hid it. He hid it by himself and nobody else knew where it was. And several things are worth noting here. For one,
do we know that it's, whether it's a separate record that it's gospel or could it be something lost?
What's the separate record? This isn't in his gospel.
I know, but was it one of those plain and precious parts that got
Yes,
removed?
It was part. It was lost. We don't have it. No.
But do you think it was part of his original but just got...
Well, this is the interesting point. We're going to talk about that very thing. He wrote lots of things that are not. Remember, the Book of Mormon tells us that. Remember that John, the only New Testament character mentioned in the Book of Mormon is John. He's named. And what it says about him is that he wrote a lot of things we don't have yet, but that we're going to get. Now, this is an interesting thing here. First Nephi talks about that. The Dead Sea Scrolls come from the time of John. He's the central, at the very same time, of course, the time of the apostle, the time of the early church, just before and after. And John lived before and he lived after the church, too. And they were nearly all written on parchment. The scrolls are parchment. Sometimes they're untreated leather, nearly all they're treated leather, elegant leather, which is parchment. And they were deliberately hidden up. We know that, too, regular practice. And what's more, the Dead Sea Scrolls show closer affinity to John than any other writer. This was first pointed out by Albright. And it was declared from the very first, and still declared, that the meaning of the Dead Sea Scrolls will only be understood when we understand the meaning of the Johannine writings, what the Johannine writings were all about, mostly John. So that the idea that John here, that John wrote on parchment and that he hid what he had written, is not impossible or absurd at all. It's just exactly the sort of thing that was going on then. And you say there was something else we have to mention here. It's also a valuable commentary, incidentally, on the prophet's activity as a translator. He never had that scroll. He didn't have it at all. Yet he's translated. It's a particular, it's a special document. So there is such a document. The question is asked, did Joseph Smith know Egyptian? Of course he didn't know it. Then the book of Abraham must be a fraud, they say. They always reject it, the strangest thing, of course, the whole thing. It had to come by revelation. He didn't translate it. He said the translation was given to him. He said the translation was given to us. And the same thing here. Here we have a translation. It says here, the revelation is the translated version of the record made on parchment. It was a real, tangible, physical record. John made it. He hid it up near the Dead Sea there. You can be sure of that. That's where they were hidden by the thousands. And just at that particular time, they were not hidden later. They're not hidden earlier. You know, John's time. And he hid them there, and to come forth at a later time, with that in view. I'm going to read a section here in a minute. Here. And this is explicitly mentioned as the source of the revelation. So the question arises, did Joseph Smith ever have this parchment, this manuscript in his hands? No. Did he ever claim to? What language was it written in? Didn't make any difference. Whatever language it was written in, he wouldn't know it. How did he translate it? He was working with the Urim and Thummim, we're told here. Well, then we're just left up in the air. All right, we just have to take his word for it, and that's all. But already it looks pretty good. I mean, he's not said anything absurd, because this is exactly the sort of thing John would do. Now, you talk about Johannine writings. I was about to go up the hill and get bring down three recently, all discovered within the last, 20 years already? No, near the last 15 years. The three apocryphas of John, 1, 2, and 3. It must amount to several hundred pages in Coptic. Tremendous writings attributed to John, very early, but always attributed to John coming in. But now we come to a very funny thing. We read this parchment written by John. There are two verses about John, and all the rest of it's about Peter. It's a direct quotation of what the Lord said to Peter. So quotations are to Peter, and Peter wrote it, I pray thee, Peter, and so forth. When you go into these Johannine writings, what do you find today? They're mostly about Peter. It's a funny thing again. This scroll business, the way these things are stuck around, is very interesting. I'm going to read you a section here on that sort of thing. Thotlemy, good old Thotlemy, reports that when writings inscribed on metal plates, now Thotlemy was the Persian, first the earliest commentator on the Quran, and when the Persians became Muslims, they had to find out what the Quran was about, and it was full of Old Testament prophets. And the Persians, having been Zoroastrians, didn't know anything about the Old Testament prophets. So Thotlemy, who was a very clever man, went around visiting all the Jewish villages in Persia, whither the Jews had fled when Jerusalem fell, and had long conversations with them and writes them down, and this is his interviews, and these are the stories they tell about these prophets. So it's the Qisas al-Anbiya, the stories of the prophets by Thotlemy. It's a great work, the most valuable work we have commentating on the Quran. And he tells us here about these sectaries that lived in the desert and the records they kept, and the records are created here. Doing this thing is what I want to mention here now. Thotlemy reports that when writings inscribed on metal plates, notice inscribed on metal plates, were found in a cave in Yemen, it's way down at the southern end of Arabia there, no one could decipher them until one of the traveling smiths or artisans was consulted. They were one of the Rechabites, wandering in the desert, belonged to the cult, to go back to Lehi at the time. Remember, Lehi was probably a Rechabite himself. But they could read it. They could read what was on these metal plates, according to Thotlemy. This is noteworthy because some scholars have seen in these nomadic craftsmen the descendants of the Rechabites and hence the possible ancestors of the Qumran community. The earliest Oriental version of the Seven Sleepers story actually comes from Najran, the borders of Yemen. Mazinyan explains this by showing that the Feast of the Martyrs, Muhammad, how to get into this. Well, Al-Rakim, now the word Al-Rakim, that's what they use for metal plates that are inscribed. Does that suggest anything to you, inscribed metal plates? We're going to get the parchments along with this, and to John and Peter too. This is the funny thing. This all ties in together. I'm going to make a plan here where I wrote it down. So this is what I was going to use my valuable chalk for. Where did it go? Oh, here we are. Name the district, EC7. That's not a plane, that's the section we're talking about, Doctrine and Covenants now. And this is paralleled very closely by 1335, 17 following. Now, in the scrolls, the theme is various stages of immortality. That's the theme of both of them. Thematically, They're very closely related. And thematically, they're also related with certain scrolls. The scrolls here, well, as by way of evidence, they're confirmed by scrolls, not just the Dead Sea Scrolls, but others. We're starting to mention the metal plates and things like that here. But other scrolls, especially the Dead Sea Scrolls, and this strikingly confirmed, which is also confirmed, by the Gospel of the 12 Apostles. This is a recent, it was discovered in 1913, just one of the very first to be discovered. Gospel of the 12 Apostles. This tells the same story that 3rd Nephi tells, and this tells the same story. They all tell the same story that Tom told. They all mix up together. Showing, and there's a very valuable text. We talked about, mentioned it in the different class on the Abaton. This also was first edited in about 1913. Now the thing is, all these things relate together, and section 7 ties them together so beautifully. Notice, not only the nature of the document, the circumstances under which it was produced, by whom, how it was treated, by John, on parchment, confidential, hidden up, and so forth. Now we find parchments hidden up by John's contemporaries, and what's the first thing they discover on reading them? This all has to do with John. John is the secret of the whole thing. Well, and now, they call the letter, the metal plates, arakim, is what the Arabs call them, and this is a very mysterious word. It baffles everybody. Here's some of the meanings of rakim. I think this is fun. May bore you to tears. Go away, that's all right. It means writings engraved or scratched on something, a brass plate or stone tablet placed at the mouth of a cave, Sale suggests, though he's not sure. Or else it is two tablets in a sealed copper box with silver seals, or it is simply a book, or even a golden tablet, or perhaps it's an inscription over the cave door, or else the name of the cave itself, or the wadi where it is, canyon, or possibly the mountain, or it may have been the stone that blocked the entrance, or else it's the ruins near the cave, or even the village where the cave people dwell. This is the Al-Kahf, the 18th surah of the Quran. It's called the Al-Kahf, the surah of the people of the cave. Who were the people of the cave? Well, they were these Dead Sea Scrolls people, and there's a record of it here in the Quran, so nobody ever knows it. Well, I pointed out in this article in the Review to Qumran, years ago, and it's been reprinted here. Or else, but what is rakim? Or it may refer to water. Well, we're just getting warmed up here. What rakim means, a typical Arabic word, is fire, it's hard to get the word to mean anything you want it to mean. But that's an interesting thing. They have the principle of the bottle. The principle of the bottle. That explains the two sides of the brain working together. The rule of bottle is, it's in Egyptian, but it's infallible in Arabic, namely, in speaking or writing, you can use any word you want. Any word you want, as long as the person you're talking to understands what you're talking about. If you say, I live in the hill, when he knows you live in the house, it's perfectly all right. I live in a sugar bowl, that's fine. You can refer to it as anything you want to. You call your places diggings, he knows you don't dig in the ground and live in a hole. In England, you call your rooms your digs and all this sort of things. But as long as the hearer understands, you can use any word you want. Well, anyway, these words, can be, depending on the context, what you're talking about, but it always refers to these people, these sectaries of the desert out there, keeping their records. Or it may refer to water holes or running water in the wadi. Or on the other hand, it may refer to coins or to an inkstand or writing desk found on the spot. You know, they found those. Qumran did. Or it may be the dog that guarded the cave, who is also called Qumran. It's very interesting. Rakim. Dog, the holy dog guarding the cave. Stranger. We're always getting off the subject here. We might as well. The introduction to this tells a story of where I visited the cave in the first place when I was writing this article. I visited with Rafik Najani, who was the head of the Antiquities of Jordan. He's a cousin of the king, who's very nice. He read the manuscript here and he was impressed, so we went out to visit this cave, which they said was the original cave we talked about. And it was a fascinating place. And we went back 12 years later. It was way out in the wilderness. Nothing was there. It was just wild, rocky country in the open desert. And they started to dig, and they made some pretentious diggings and had good going. And we happened to be there at noon of the winter solstice. And we're told in some old Arab writers that that's the time that the sun shines in the cave on the holy dog. And sure enough, the sun shone right in the cave just at that time. It was low enough too, you see. And back in the end of the cave, there's an old, some say it goes back to the 4th century, say it's older, a painting of a dog. Sure enough, this is the holy dog. Okay. And so the digging continued. And actually, when we went back with the group 12 years later, I was all excited to see how the digging had gone. And so no more digging. They covered it up. covered the cave up. Incidentally, it was an old foundation. It looked just like the Dead Sea Scrolls. Ancient olive trees and all this sort of stuff. And the walls were there and community houses and everything. They covered them all up. This is way out in the eastern. So this is east of Jordan. And instead, there was a huge mosque going up there. A reinforced concrete shell that was going up. There was a large slab inscribed in Arabic and English saying, "This is the cave of the holy martyrs." Bus trips were being run out of pilgrims. It had become a pilgrimage place. I went up to the cave wasn't there, except it was closed. And at the door, there was an old mullah and his assistant, and they offered to sell me a candle. I would like the candle, and we'd go in. And I asked him, "What about the holy dog?" He felt. And he said, "Oh, you won't see the holy dog. Well, that's extra. Come in here." And at the back of the cave was a huge commode with a glass front, dirty, old, and so forth. And then this were a lot of old, brown, withered bones. And then was Exhibit A, the jawbone of the dog. You see. And that was the holy jawbone. That was the holy dog. Now imagine that in the space of 12 years, here had come an ancient pilgrim, a shrine. This is the cave of the seven sleepers. This is the bone of the holy dog. There had been nothing there before. Nobody knew anything about it. But the Jordan government thought, aha, may be a good tourist attraction and a great thing to draw pilgrims and money. So this big mosque is going up, and for Muslims only. And here is the holy cave and the holy dog. And all this stuff is set up in 12 years. Then anyone say, well, here's a sacred shrine. Since time immemorial, they have been going here to worship the holy dog. And people take pilgrimages there and they say, well, that's the world we live in. I mean, this isn't the way pilgrimages begin and so forth. But to see it happen before your very eyes in 12 years, and to have it documented, I took pictures like mad when I went out the first time. A lot of them were published in the era there. They were rather good. And I had a dinky little old black and white one. Not very much of a camera, but it was good. It was stolen. As it were.
He stole it or
but how things go. Absolutely astonishing the world. And here, the most obvious clue of all has no place in the Rakim tradition. Instead, we are confronted with a combination of caves, writings, bones, ruins, coins, inkstands, wadis. There's no mention of the valley in any of the Orthodox stories. Well, then he goes on here. Now here, the general consensus is that Al-Rakim refers to secret buried writings containing the history and the teachings of the companions. The idea that the ancients did bury their writings in their history. Remember when Joseph Smith came out with this? The biggest joke of all was the gold Bible, a hidden place, all this sort of stuff. This was for laughing. Now, of course, we realize this is the way things were really done. Now we're here, and then, that's an interesting footnote here, that's what we're going to refer to. These were whose meaning God has kept from us and whose history we do not know. I think that's Elkhart of Bitok, and sure enough, is. Here's an interesting thing. Most commentators, including those listed here, note that the tablets contain the names and history of the sleepers. Kurtubi would even include the writings, quote, of the rule which they embraced from the religion of Jesus. The first of the Dead Sea Scrolls discovered was the Sirach Scroll. They call the Manual of Discipline, their doctrine and covenants, the rule by which the scroll lived, but that was before the time of Jesus. Now here's an Arab writer saying, among the writings that they hid in their caves, were the rule al-Ash'ari tamassukuhu bihi min dina Isa, the rules which they embraced or were converted to from the religion of Jesus. See, they shifted over, joined the religion of Jesus, kept the rules, and he says those rules you'll still find buried in the caves. So we get such interesting affinities to the Book of Mormon here. They were deliberately hidden away to come forth in a later age when perhaps God will raise up a believing people, as Thatlabi and Tabari and Baidawi and Amiri all say. Incidentally, the most valuable manuscript of Baidawi in the world is in the BYU library here. Nobody even knows it's there. I don't tell anybody it'd be missing. It's not on the open shelves for a miracle. I keep it locked in the safe where it should be. It's a magnificent Baidawi manuscript. Magnificently illuminated, too, along with that 15th century. Well, and he goes on. There was a tradition that Jeremiah, with the same purpose, had hidden such treasures in a cave near Jericho. And, of course, the Dead Sea Scroll is the short walk from Jericho. That's where they are, the caves are. That you'll find in the Book of Maccabees. That's in 2 Maccabees. You'll find that in the Jewish records. At the time of the First Crusades, local reports located the cave near Jericho also, Fulker tells us. And when the patriarch Timotheus of Alexandria, a very important man, was this is later than this Timotheus that wrote the Avatar. about the year 800 of the discovery of documents in caves near Jericho, so they were finding these once in a while. He assumed that it was those buried by Jeremiah. But, more interesting, there was a tradition that Jeremiah, with the same purpose, had hidden such treasures near Jericho as Peter had done near Jerusalem. According to Baidawi, it was Peter who discovered the documents of the cave and Peter who hid them. Now, when we start reading this document, this parchment that was hidden up by John, the whole thing is about Peter. And it's taken from a direct writing of Peter because it's first person here. And the Lord's talking to Peter. A strange thing. And it was Peter who discovered the documents of Al-Riki. And the theme of the buried holy books had special appeal to Thalaby, who carries the custom back to the remotest times. He takes the custom back to the burial of Aaron. He tells of a book sent to David from heaven, sealed with gold and containing 13 questions to be put to Solomon. Of an apocalyptic writing sealed in an iron box. Of another buried in a mountain. Of gold tablets containing the history of a vanished empire found in a cave in Yemen. Of magic books dug up from beneath Solomon's throne. All these traditions, all these ways of handing down the records. I say, Joseph Smith got such a laugh for it. That's routine now. He's right in the proper environment. And this plunges us right into it. Now remember, this was published before the Book of Mormon came out. This April 1929 issue here. Strange thing. Well, the recently recognized possibility that the Library of Qumran was deliberately buried in a solemn communal interment to come forth in a more righteous age, thus supplies another link between Qumran and companions of the cave and the Riki, while putting a new stamp of authenticity on their existence. Well, so these things do hang together. This is not in a vacuum, but now I want to talk about this, the content of this and so forth. The question then, does the content of this revelation bear out its claim? It's a commentary on an episode in the Book of Mormon. That's this one in 3rd Nephi. Much neglected story, nobody's paying attention to it. A few weeks ago, we talked about the Lakish letters to the state fireside. Astonishingly confirming 1st Nephi. Those Lakish letters are wonders. Documents actually from the time of Nephi. The time that we actually have them describing the situation then. It comes much closer to 1st Nephi than I had ever realized before. And shortly after that, a couple of weeks ago, Jack Anderson talked here on an episode telling us that the best possible guide to what's going on in Washington and the world today and everywhere else is the Book of Mormon. You can't believe it. It's fresher than today's news, he said. And he was talking about it. It gives a miraculously accurate picture, explicit and detailed, of our time. Think of these things in the Book of Mormon aspects. And here's yet another aspect of the Book of Mormon. And I think the greatest challenge of Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon was, of course, to produce another New Testament. So the Lord came after the resurrection, did he? And he talked to the people, did he? All right, what did he say? What did he do? Imagine telling this to believing Christians, that you're going to give them the words of Jesus Christ, who appeared after the resurrection. What did he do? Who did he talk to? Where did he go? What went on? Now, that would be something to make good. And, of course, no 40-day literature was known in the time of Joseph Smith. In the last 50 years, and mostly the last 20, a great 40-day literature has come forth. Well, in fact, at the time I wrote this one on the 40-day literature in here, that's not included in this particular one. When the lights went out. The 40-day ministry of Jesus Christ, it's called the Evangelium Quadragesimo, the Gospel of the 40 Days. At the time that came out, there were only half as many 40-day manuscripts as there are now. And that was just in 1965. About 1965. And since then, there have been almost twice as many. That time, I could only refer to the Apocalypse of James, the Gospel of James. Since then, it has come out and been edited in style and so forth. It has just been discovered there. Well, in other words, we have a whole library of works telling us what the Lord did after the 40 days, after the resurrection. There was nothing on that before. Joseph Smith talks about it. This is what 3rd Nephi. He visits them after the resurrection. What does he do? What does he say? Well, I'm going to run down the list here. When making good such a claim as Joseph Smith makes in 3rd Nephi, Jesus Christ comes and preaches to the people. All right, all you have to do is quote the New Testament, but he doesn't do that. He gives us more things. And that's really dangerous ground. He's really asking for trouble when you start doing things like that. You know, you better look out. He'd made this colossal promise that he was going to give them this, And how could he possibly make it good to the believing world, to the learned world? Well, many authors, incidentally, like Lew Wallace or Lloyd Douglas and others, have written sentimental novels about Jesus, and like Quo Vadis, about Jesus appearing in the resurrection and so forth. But all are obvious combinations of using New Testament subjects and, well, Walter Pater too, and romantic and sentimental treatment of it, and the writer isn't committed, he's only writing a novel after all. Joseph Smith is playing a different thing entirely, he's being very specific. So let's refer to a document that's singularly instructive here. Writing in 1913, Revillot, this is this document, the Gospel of the Twelve Apostles, who an Egyptian Coptic scholar, says he discovered a remarkable document, a text of the Gospel of the Twelve Apostles. He discovered it just before 1913. And he points out that Origen, the first and greatest of the Christian theologians, regarded this as the oldest and sacred book of the Christians. He considered it, along with the Gospel of the Egyptians, to be, quote, the most ancient apocryphal gospel, perhaps older than the Gospel of Luke, and mentioned by him in his prologue. This is what Luke is referring to, at least as you get very many versions of things. Origen and Jerome distinguish two kinds of apocrypha when they talk about this. They say, now there are all sorts of apocryphal writings going around, but this is different. This has something to it. This is solid. They say, there are those writings of those who seek to scribble, and that is simply to expand or discuss what's already in the New Testament. And they say, of which this is the best example. And then there's those who want to ordinare narrationum, that's the formula, that is to compose or invent, such as the infancy gospel, the proto-gospels of James and Thomas and so forth. They tell of things and places and situations that are marvelous, miraculous, not found anywhere else, not mentioned in the New Testament. But they go on, and there's a great bulk of them. They're the two kind, but once in a while you get a very old and authentic one. There were very few up until quite recently. Now we get the oldest of them all, and you know what, 90% of them, if you find a very old Christian writing, the chances are 10 to 1, it will talk about what? It will have this title on it, The Secret Teachings of the Lord and the Apostles After the Resurrection. Well, how did those happen to survive? Because they were buried, they were secret. They always contained great admonitions to secrecy, as this does, and they were buried and hidden for that reason. And now that the digging has become intense looking for them, we're beginning to find them. That's why they have survived. And moreover, nobody would take them seriously, and they were all destroyed otherwise in the time of Theodosius. They were all ordered destroyed. It was capital punishment to possess one of those, so they disappeared. And the world hasn't had them for centuries. But now they're coming back like this. And now the old authentic ones are beginning to appear in large numbers. And Revillot himself points out way back then that the early fathers did not view this gospel of the 12 apostles with suspicion, as they did the other writings. He says it has a tone de bon foi historique, it has a tone of good, of historical good faith and directness and simplicity, which is totally strange to the fragments of the Gnostic gospels and the rest of them. The writings it comes closest to contain passages which the fathers of the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century all considered authentic. He says the author of our text, who he thinks might have been Gamaliel, either Gamaliel, the older or the younger, who joined the church, the great Jewish scholar, he might be the one who kept this. But he didn't want to stop with the resurrection of Christ. He goes beyond. What he's talking about is what happened after the resurrection. He takes the history as far as 15 years after, he says. And while he assumes as a matter of course that the text can't possibly go back to the time of the apostles and Gamaliel, that is, Revillot himself does, still he's very perplexed at the end. He says, I can't understand. There are undoubted evidences of great antiquity to it, and it's full of little bits that only somebody very early could have known and that were banished by the church later on. Of all things, he says, it is strictly orthodox and not Gnostic at all. He notes, however, some of the peculiar teachings have the support of Origen himself, who also became a Gnostic insofar that he believed the strange doctrine that the dead could be converted, hear the gospel after the afterlife, and be saved. And what he forgets, Revillot states, Origen doesn't state this is one of his own beliefs, though. He says this is what the elders taught in the early church. We don't know whether it's true or not today anymore. We don't teach it anymore. But this is what the elders taught, namely, that the dead will yet hear the gospel preached and there will be a chance for him to be saved. Well, this is the way the text goes. Starts out reminding one of Luke. He's talking here. I'm just going to mention some things in parallel with the Book of Mormon here. It says, if you really want to know, see again, showing that things were questioned and so forth, listen and I will tell you. Did not God feel an equal love for all his apostles? Listen to John the evangelist. So it goes right to John and starts out with him. And the theme is the same as treated in here. When John left a scroll, this is what he talked about, namely, what happens, how, the question here, whether he tarried in the flesh or died. Because that's what this deals with. Who tarries in the flesh, who dies? What are the various levels of life? You're not just living or dead. There are other places, pleasures in between. And Moroni, I remember, speculates on this and gets all hot and bothered about it. And so does this. That's what they're talking about. And so especially does this. He's writing, but attributed to John, buried, brought up from the cave, and so forth. Well, to John the Baptist, testifying how Christ used to plead with his father, so his, on their behalf, even that they become one as he had become one. Well, that's 1933, we go to the Book of Mormon, this is 13th Nephi, the 19th, 20th chapters especially are rich in these passages, and passages like here, Our Father, I pray unto thee also for them, that also those who believe in thee, that they that thou become one, that they may be one, that they may be in, that I may be in them, Father, as thou art in me, that we may be one. That's a typical verse here, and it's the same thing. Even that they may be one, even as we are. Do you want to know the truth about it? It is that he chose the 12, then he recalled, unfortunately the manuscript breaks off here, there's something missing, quite a section missing here. And when it opens, the Lord has come, and the people are, he has the multitude out there, and this is what it says. Incidentally, I translate this very rapidly and very, I think when you go rapidly like this, and impulsively, you really get better results. Going back over it after, this is the best way of putting it. I have the Xerox here in case you want to raise any questions. It's a Coptic manuscript. You want to know, upon them saying, he cast his eyes upon them saying, I feel concerned for this multitude. The word pity, he uses here. For behold, they have been with me for 3 days, and now they have nothing to eat. I don't want to let them leave here hungry, lest they faint by the wayside. And Andrew said to him, My Lord, where will we find bread in the wilderness? Well, when the Lord came to the Nephites, they were in the wilderness, remember, and everything had been destroyed, and the apostles ask him here in the 6th verse, Now there had been no bread, neither wine brought by the disciples, neither by the multitude. And yet he also gave them to drink. And they were out in the desert here, and he told them to get it, and they said, Here, well, where are we going to get it? And the same thing in the Book of Mormon. Jesus said to Thomas, Go to a certain man who has with him 5 loaves of barley bread and 2 fishes and bring them to me here. And Andrew said to him, Lord, how far would 5 loaves go with such a huge crowd? Jesus saith, Bring them unto me, and there will be enough. And this the same thing here. He's talking to the people. They've been out 3 days, remember, and he's talking to them in the wilderness, the same situation. And they had nothing to eat. And there had been no bread, neither wine brought by the disciples, either by the multitude. And it's that he makes a sacrament of the meal. And of course, in the last, especially during the 1960s, lots of articles came out, Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish, on the Last Supper, on the feeding of the loaves and fishes as a type of the sacrament. That the Lord actually was giving them the sacrament when he fed them with the loaves and fishes. And that's what he does here. He feeds them miraculously in the wilderness, and it's the sacrament at the same time. So they went, tells us, and a small child was brought to Jesus and straightway began to worship. And he holds a sophisticated conversation with the child. And remember, in the Book of Mormon, the first thing he does is he blesses the children. But then it says he used to do that when he visited them during the time he would come. It tells us in the 26th chapter and the 14th verse there. And it came to pass he did minister unto the children of the multitude whom it had been spoken. And he did loose their tongues, and they did speak unto their fathers great and marvelous things, even greater than he had revealed unto the people. And he loosed their tongues that they could utter. And here all of a sudden, a small child is brought to him, and he talks with more wisdom than their parents, and they can't understand it. And presently they brought the loaves to him, the 2 fishes. The small child said to Jesus, Lord, I had a hard time getting these. I've suffered much because of these. We know what these are. Does it refer to the loaves of fishes or the people? What he says is they've given me a hard time. Jesus saith to the child, Give me the 5 loaves which have been entrusted to you. Since it's not you who have saved this multitude in need, but it has been so arranged, that is the oikonomia, he says, using the Greek word, that you might behold marvelous things, the memory of which shall never pass away, and food with which they shall be filled. Of course, the idea that they will really be filled in this, and back to 35 again, in the 8th verse, where it says 28, and he said unto them,
He that eateth of this bread eateth of my body and my soul, and he that drinketh of me, my blood and my soul, and his soul shall never hunger, nor thirst, but shall be filled. So he tells them this food is going to have that effect on them, just exactly as he does. He's actually feeding them here, too, in both books. And here he says, they shall be filled. And Jesus, well, 26:14, yes. And Jesus took the loaves and gave thanks to his Father for them and divided them and gave them to the apostles for them to carry to the multitude. That's exactly what he does in 3:25, and then again when he visits them again in 26. At 3:25 it says here, for example, when they had given unto the multitude, he also gave them wine to drink and commanded them that they should give them to the multitude, giving it to the apostles. And then in 26 and 13, I just looked up these during testimony meeting, so I'm going to run here. 26:13. But if I could pick them up that easily, see, there's a remarkable parallel in this short span of the Book of Mormon with this particular doctrine. This says here, it came to pass that he did teach them and minister unto the children. The multitude had been spoken to speak in tongues. He's talking about ministering to them here. And, wait a minute. We're talking about, 26:13, yes. Oh, therefore, I would that ye should behold that the Lord truly did teach the people for the space of 3 days, and after that he did show himself unto them oft, and did break bread oft, and bless it, and give it unto them. Whenever he met with them after that, he would have the sacrament. So it's not surprising here that he does it in the old world, too. What did he do when he returned in the old world? You see, this is a surprising thing. The book of Acts tells us that he did come, that he visited them for a period of 40 days, off and on. He used to visit them and teach them. It makes that very clear. But we don't know what he did, but here it tells us that he had the sacrament with them. He did it every time. That's a significant part. And then something happens here. Andrew said to Jesus, Lord, didn't Judas get a share when he came to get some to carry to the multitude? Then it breaks off, unfortunately, because what thou sayest, for he to whom I have not given a portion of bread from my hands is not worthy of any part of my flesh. And again, Nephi 28, he says the same thing, and it's your damnation if you do it unworthily. Then, this is the mystery of my Father which concerns the partaking or dividing of my flesh. Of course, he says the same thing. Where he says here, for example, he drinketh of the wine, drinketh of my blood, and he who eateth of my... he that eateth this bread eateth of my body to his soul. And here he says, of course, this is the mystery of my Father. And unfortunately, it's a... Imagine, very subtle, probably by your own way. And ask for a gift of translation. Then you will translate it again, and they'll change the translation they've got, so that, ah, you see, that's wrong. So that Jonas can't possibly win. There's nothing he can do about it. But, after all, isn't that a fair test? Wouldn't that be a fair test? Yes, it would be a fair test if they didn't cheat by changing the manuscript when they had it. Behold, they say, they think in their hearts, we will see if God has given him power to translate. Now, they're asking an honest question. They're saying, well, does he really have the power to translate? That's right, if they really meant it. But you notice the next, that they intend to trip him up no matter what he does. And therefore, see, they're going to cheat by changing the score. 17th verse, yes.
Something I don't understand. A while back, you said that Martin Harris's wife actually burned them.
Yes. Well, that was years later. She kept them. They gave them back to her, and she kept them. They were going to try to smuggle it back to Joseph the best way they could, you see. But she kept them around, and finally, it got too hot, and so she made them hotter. Well, that's just their account. Now, my father told me this, that his mother, the last time he talked with her, told him that story, too. And, of course, his mother, Rebecca and Ivor, they lived up in Cache Valley at that very time, and she was quite a close friend, sister of hers, earlier. And I don't know how that works out. But anyway, they had them, and they never got them back, is the point. And they could have done what they wanted with them, and I say they got too hot to handle, they could burn them, they could do anything they want. But they didn't have them. But it doesn't make any difference. Here's a surprising thing. Joseph Smith does repeat them. He does duplicate them from the fuller manuscript of Nephi, because there were two, there was the abbreviated and the other one, and they can't see them, because he says the same thing here. But since it's a different manuscript, they can't alter things and get away with it. And they're convinced for themselves that he's telling the same story. If he told a totally different story, then they could have brought it forth unaltered, the manuscript.
in Oliver's own hand as far as that goes. He said, look, here's the manuscript. And you told a very different story the first time around. He told the same second story. He told the story again, as we see. And they never brought the manuscript up against him. They couldn't change it. Because it was from another text. It was from the fuller place, a fuller version on the place, and yet it was very clever, somebody. But here, the ninth verse, 19th verse there, therefore they will destroy him and also the work in the house of cards theory. This has been pulled again and again. We can find one serious mistake. Somebody came to me this morning, yeah, to write a letter now, a relative of theirs in California. There are three pages, the manuscript of the Book of Mormon have never been accounted for, three pages, that the handwriting has never been explained. Whose handwriting is? Well, who cares as far as that goes? We have these chapters knowing what's going on. But because of that, you see, the Book of Mormon must be a fraud. The Book of Mormon is a fraud. Joseph Smith is a fraud. If Joseph Smith is a fraud, the church is a fraud. Everything is a fraud. Everything collapses. That's the house of cards theory. And they love it, you see. And you just found, if you can find Joseph Smith making one little slip, it's all up, you see. No, this is natural because they follow the old doctrine of all or nothing. You see, the idea, the old sectarian idea, that every letter in the Bible was written by the finger of God. So if you were to find one mistake in the Bible, the whole thing would have to collapse. It must be absolutely all perfect to nothing. They don't realize our doctrine that prophets are human and the scriptures have had lots of changes and alterations. They themselves get out different translations, different versions, different texts of the Bible, editions of the Bible all the time, realizing the text and alterations must be changed. But we've grown up with that idea, the sectarian world, that it has to be either all or nothing. If God has anything to do with it, it must be perfect. If there's anything wrong with it, it can't be of God because it is not absolutely perfect. Well, that's absurd. But that's the argument they do use all the time. The interesting thing is, though, why all such attempts have failed? Why have they all looked so promising? Because of this doctrine of infallibility. For a prophet to make one mistake is fatal to his claims. And so well, there's infallibility, which we don't preach. This very chapter is a very good one because Joseph Smith is being taken to task here. He's far from infallible. And that we may not be ashamed in the end, this is still the verse goes on, that is proven wrong by subsequent events, that we may get glory of the world. This is what they're talking about. And this has been their number one motive, why they have done this. All these operations, the learned participants, have wanted to make a splash for themselves. They've all rushed to the prince. They've all got national coverage and international coverage in the newspapers. They've done it recently with this Pearl Great Price thing, the same sort of thing. This is their idea. Therefore, we will destroy him. That's the first step. And also the work, the whole thing will be wiped out just by altering this manuscript. One change in the manuscript will do it, you see. And we will do this that we may not be ashamed in the end because they felt themselves in a very compromising position. They'll be proven wrong by subsequent evidence. Just as sure as anything that the evidence is going to come out. If it's true, the evidence will favor it inevitably. So in order to prevent that happening, that we may not be ashamed in the end, and also that we'll get plenty of notoriety, fame, celebrity, and so forth. These people, second Donald Trump, these people parade themselves around as so important and make such a big production. The fact that they found that Joseph Smith did not translate the Book of Breathings in the Book of Abraham. Well, nobody ever said he did, but that's the situation. They do it for these very things. So the very same thing is happening today in 1978. It happened the very same thing, only now they're doing it with the papyrus. And again, the alterations in 1912, when they came out, they didn't have any of the original papyri, and they immediately charged that Joseph Smith had made important changes, that he'd redrawn, that he'd left certain figures out, that he's changed the head of this one, and that he's... Well, there were a dozen major changes. There they are, way back in the 1850s. Made an examination of facsimile one and showed half a dozen things. He says that Joseph Smith has changed so that he could interpret it his way. Well, since then, we have the original manuscript today, 1967, discovered the original again, and nothing has been changed. That's a very good copy. Everything is as it should be. So there you are. Well, now we have a little round here. Any means, mining all?